In fact, I always draw from the inspirations I draw from are quite personal and things I remember. The movies I love to watch, the comedies, and a lot of those were Hollywood. They were Laurel and Hardy films or Buster Keaton.
This is The Sparkcast, a bi-weekly show where we explore the creativity, technology, and business of CG. I'm your host, Marina Antunes.
What inspires a creative genius to transform the mundane into the magical? Join us as we uncover the origins of a celebrated animator whose journey began in the gritty yet charming landscape of Preston. With stories that intertwine personal history with artistic evolution, Nick Park shares how a childhood steeped in creativity led to a lifelong passion for animation. Drawing from a tapestry of early experiences, including the influence of a photographer father and a tailor mother, we explore the whimsical elements that define iconic works like Wallace and Gromit. Our conversation traverses the early days of stop-motion magic, fueled by an adventurous spirit and family support. At the heart of Nick's creative journey are beloved projects like A Grand Day Out and Creature Comforts, which garnered acclaim even before the age of social media virality. We celebrate the slow crescendo of Wallace and Gromit's cultural impact, revealing how these characters came to embody the quintessential charm of British animation. We also pull back the curtain on the collaborative artistry that breathes life into these timeless characters. This conversation is a heartfelt homage to the enduring legacy of Wallace and Gromit, a testament to Nick's inventive craftsmanship, and a warm tribute to the personal influences that continue to inspire. Here's our conversation with Nick Park.
I wanted to start by asking you about growing up in Preston. What was that like?
Preston, I don't know if you've ever been here. It's an industrial town that has quite a history. It's not a big town. It's now a city, actually. It's been promoted to being a city about 10 years ago or something. If you've ever seen anything like Coronation Street, it's that kind of quite working class, lots of pubs, and a lot of those houses were built around the mills in the Industrial Revolution sort of era. But my mum, she grew up in that part of town. My dad's family were a bit more well off and they lived a bit out of town. They moved out to this kind of village come suburb when I was about 4 years old. So we were about 5 miles out of Preston. But I always loved the history of Preston. I think the word comes from priest town. So it was quite a Catholic kind of area. It's all very varied now, but very diverse. But yeah, it wasn't a big town, but I actually always loved it. As I loved going into town, I loved the museum. I loved to go and look at the artifacts, the skulls, and the dugout canoes and things that were found in the river and around the Ice Age, from going back from around the Ice Age. I scoured the library as well. My dad was a photographer and my mother was a tailor, and all our clothes were made by my mother and everything else was made by my dad, all the shelves and all the tables and chairs and everything. Five siblings grew up in one house. I had quite a large family and they were all quite artistic. My parents encouraged us to be artistic and creative. My sister still paints a lot and does a lot of printmaking. And I went to a comprehensive Catholic high school in Preston. I always loved drawing cartoons when I was a kid. The comic that everyone knew in the UK was called the Beano. It was like a funny comic rather than adventure, or not superheroes or anything. And it was always like kids on the corner of the street getting up to mischief and knocking helmets off the local bobby and that kind of thing. So there's a lot of that kind of upbringing. The comics I used to read, they are in the latest Wallace and Gromit film, and all of the Wallace and Gromit films have that thing, the street environment, the terraced houses, and the kind of humble two up, two down, terraced houses, which all look very formal, but crazy things can be happening in them. The locals are all full of colour and interesting and all a bit quirky and offbeat. It's this It's a little bit like the Beatles movies or the Ealing comedies.
That's amazing that the things that have made it into Wallace and Gromit, and which really play a big part in the way that the characters and that universe feels very British. Go back to you growing up in Preston and the surroundings that you grew up in and the experience that you had as a child.
Yeah, absolutely. In fact, I always draw from the inspirations I draw from are quite personal and things I remember. The movies I love to watch, the comedies, and a lot of those were Hollywood. They were Laurel and Hardy films or Buster Keaton. Back then in the 60s and 70s, all kinds of stuff was on TV for general viewing. You'd have a show that just showed old black and white comedy, mostly from Hollywood. And there'd be another show, just clips from cartoons, any across the board, Disney cartoons, Chuck Jones, Warner Brothers, whatever it was, and Tex Avery, a whole medley of different cartoons. And it just kept us entertained. But the references in the movies themselves, round at my granny's house, like the standard lamp next to Wallace and Gromit's chair in the ground out was exactly from my granny's house. Even the pole that held up the light shade was exactly what my granny had. And there's a tea tray that Wallace brings in the tea and crackers in, like a wicker handles on them. And there's a Swiss Alpine scene, that photograph on it. And that was exactly what we had in the house.
You mentioned sketching. Are you always, and maybe more in the past, were you always like just drawing things that you saw around you, not really knowing what they were going to be used for, but just because it was something to do?
Yeah, art classes were always encouraging us to draw what we see, a still life or whatever it was, or some fruit or whatever. But I tended to be more in my imagination. Sometimes I copied cartoons from comic books I had. I'd see if I could copy them, but I tended just to draw my own, and I really got hooked on doing my own cartoon strips, and that's what inspired me. My siblings were a bit more extrovert probably than me, and would all play and everything. But I tended to sit in the corner drawing a lot. And my mother says I was very up. I used to sit and observe.
It seems drawing and art were, like you mentioned, very encouraged by your family. But in Preston, there was not really, I'm assuming, an industry for this kind of thing. And yet your parents encouraged you to pursue that passion, which is not really a common thing to hear. Can you talk a little bit about sort of being pushed off to college to study art?
Yeah, I remember my first career advice sessions at high school, and no one was going into the arts. It wasn't a thing then back in Preston, and the film industry or TV even was there was something in Manchester, which was 30 miles away, but there was no movie industry that wasn't light years away, really. So that's why I would scour the library for anything I could get on how to do animation. My parents were very encouraging, and they always had this ethos that if you have a gift, you should really follow it and not be pressured to get a proper job. And I was surrounded by my peers. They had to go out and get a proper job. I felt very on my own in that sense, but my family were always backing me. First of all, I got a place at Sheffield Art School. I applied for a course there in filmmaking and animation. I applied with just the animated films, really, that I'd got under my belt that I'd made as a hobby in my parents' attic. And I think I got in really based on those films. And so that was just so exciting to go somewhere where there was actual real equipment and movie cameras and animation cameras and all these facilities and people who all loved animation and wanted to talk about it. And then with that, with a couple of short films I made there, I got into the National Film and TV School. I was even in the local paper for getting a place there. It was so far off, it was like going straight to Hollywood, sort of thing.
Well, on the outside, it looks that way. What was it like for you? You did make a big leap getting into the National Film School.
Yeah, it was a very prestigious place at the time. I heard of the occasional student that got in there. In fact, a couple of people from the course in Sheffield had followed in their footsteps. Two animators, Derek Hayes and Phil Austin, who worked together a lot. Derek Hayes is still around and very active in animation, but sadly, Phil Austin passed away in the 1980s. But I followed very much in their footsteps because they started the animation course at the film school. And in fact, they called the animation department Animation City, which then became the name of their company in London when they left film school.
Oh, that's amazing. So you've graduated from Sheffield, you have a couple of films under your belt, you get into the National Film School, you start working on more projects. When does stop motion, and specifically the type of stop motion that you make, which is very tactile — stop motion is just tactile in general, just because of what it is, but yours is even more because it's clay, and that requires somebody to mold those shapes and create those shapes. When did that become like your, not maybe not calling card, but your passion?
When I was doing animation as a hobby in my teens, I'd tried all every kind of animation apart from CGI, which didn't exist. But I tried cutout animation, felt cutouts, sticking felt cutouts on a felt board, paper cutouts, influenced by Terry Gilliam, Monty Python. I followed the work of Dick Williams and tried more rendered, like Disney, but a bit more rendered. Bob Godfrey was a big influence. And interestingly, because this feeds into the clay side, is that I was attracted to anything that was a more kind of doable and accessible. So I gravitated towards techniques that were quite more spontaneous, where you could just work with it and decide what you do along the way. And that's why clay really appealed. But like Bob Godfrey's work, which is all wobbly lines, like you didn't have to get all the cells that you needed on all the trace and paint and fine animation. Like in a Disney film, you could get a Sharpie and on some paper, that kind of hands-on animation. So I tried all sorts, but at film school, I actually wasn't quite sure which area I would specialise in when I started at film school. I'd had different ideas that lent themselves to different techniques. I did like drawn animation, and if I did draw, it would be wobbly or very rendered. And I found the snowman really inspirational in that sense. But yeah, I was looking around for the first year for different ideas where I was going to land. And I don't know quite how I landed on clay, but as it was when I did a couple of tests of Wallace's face. I think they were just video tests, actually, because I haven't seen these tests for many years, so I don't know where they are. But I was amazed how much expression you could get. I got a student work placement out at Elstree Studios for 3 weeks on Jim Henson's and Frank Oz's The Dark Crystal. And I went there and I was making tea for the special effects crew for about 3 weeks, but I just found it mesmerizing and just watching how they put stuff together. It was great watching Jim Henson and Frank Oz directing and stuff on the main set. But I was in another studio and I was watching how they were doing the effects and like underwater stuff and, you know, inks, underwater cloud stuff, and I was impressed with how they got it together, and it gave me ideas for my own project, and that's when I came up with Wallace and Gromit, or decided that these characters in sketchbooks they would turn into clay. And the real idea was that, or the kind of comic premise really, what I found funny was about this guy who builds a rocket to go to the moon in his own basement. And I had this big idea because of this work experience that I would film the whole thing upside down, and I would drop the rocket down a chute, and it would blast through the house, and I'd shoot that in slow motion, and it was all based on that kind of idea. And I realised I needed someone for Wallace, the main character, to talk to. That brought Gromit into the picture, and then started writing the script from there, really, because of this one idea. And it all seemed to suit clay and model animation and clay animation more than anything else.
Were you the only one at the National Film School working in clay and in stop motion?
I was at first, and then a year after me, Joan Ashworth joined, she then became Professor of Animation at the Royal College of Arts years after that. She's just retired from that. But we were the two stop motion. I was the only clay animator. In fact, I was the same year as David Fine and Alison Snowden, who now live in Vancouver. And David's from Canada, and he applied to the film school with a clay animation he did as a student. And or as a teenager, I think, called The Only Game in Town. And I found his kind of confidence with the storytelling in that medium, I found that quite inspiring. It's a nice little film.
So you start working on Wallace and Gromit in your first year of film school, but it's years before the project is finally finished. Can you talk a little bit about the process of creating this story that is with you for so long? Because I think you worked on it for 7 years, right?
I did, yeah. I wasn't full time on it for 7 years. I worked on it for 3 years, about 3 and a bit years while I was at film school. I started filming, I think it was about sometime in my second year. It was a 3 year course because I didn't have a crew. I did ask someone to come in and do the lighting, but they couldn't stick around because scenes were taking so long to shoot. So I grabbed them whenever I could. David and Alison both came in and did a little model making for me at one point. But other than that, I was doing all of the set building myself and the animation and learning how to light as well and doing the camera work myself. At the end of about a year and a half, I realized I'd shot one paragraph in the script, which went, "So now follows a sequence where Wallace and Gromit build a rocket." And I spent about a year and a half on it. But anyway, I was getting quite down really because money was running out, time was running out. Film school let me stay on a little. They turned a blind eye to the fact that I was overrunning. When is when I met Peter Lord and David Sproxton, who founded Aardman in Bristol, which is about 100 miles west of London. They came and I invited them to talk at the film school and they saw what I was doing, early stuff of Grande Out. And before I knew it, they called me up and said, "How would you like to come and work for us at Aardman just as a summer job?" And I did, and that was about in 1983, and really enjoyed it. And but I needed to get back and finish this film. I've got my vision, I've got this movie, I've got to finish it somehow. Carried on making very slow progress, and eventually they said, "Why don't you come and work for us, like part time, and we'll help you finish this film that's taking you so long." And that was like the best of both worlds. I get to finish my film and I can maybe earn some money as well and also get lots of experience. It was terrific. I moved straight to Bristol in 1985. They set me up in a corner. I was getting on with it, but I was not really getting much time to make Grande Out. That's why it then took me another 4 years. And I was distracted on all sorts of great projects, all sorts of TV commercials, the Sledgehammer, Peter Gabriel video, which a bunch of us were involved with, the Quay Brothers included, and Pee Wee's Playhouse was also in that period as well. And 4 years later, in 1989, I eventually finished Grande Out. And in a gap, just happened to make Creature Comforts as well.
I think this is so funny. In a gap, I just happened to make one of the greatest shorts. I wanted to ask you about the timing, and this is the reality of any creative process. Things take so long that sometimes you do get this situation where you have two pieces of work that you're really proud of that are out there in the world at the same time. But this world was much different than it is today. There wasn't social media. Short films are still really hard to watch unless they were on TV. And have two projects that start to get a lot of attention, like both of them winning awards. You're out there with both of them. I'm curious, was there like a favorite child?
What of my films, you mean?
Yeah, of those two.
Of those two? Oh, yeah, that's difficult. It's interesting because I'd worked for so long on a Grande Out, and I was spent so long thinking, "Oh, I can't wait to get this out into the world and for people to see it," because I'd put so much into it. And then it was pipped at the post in a way. Creature Comforts kind of got all the attention, which I was happy about because of the simple kind of idea, really, made a kind of bigger splash because it wasn't dependent on story, really. It was just more the idea and how it came across. And Creature Comforts, I should say, was part of a small series that Aardman were doing, and I was taking part in. There was five different directors at the studio at the time, and we each did a different 5 minute short for Channel 4 in the UK. And Peter Lord made one called War Story, which was very nice as well. And I was really playing on what Pete and David already established, which using kind of vo recorded voices and then animating character, those real life voices, if you like. Which wasn't their idea. They were also basing that on what other animators, I think the Hubblers had done in the past, and other animators in the UK also contributed to similar series as well. But yeah, Grand Day Out won the BAFTA, and then Creature Comforts won the Oscar. Both films were nominated in the BAFTA, both films were nominated in the Oscars, and Creature Comforts won the Oscar, which put me on the map. I think I went from nowhere to suddenly making this massive splash, which was incredible, really. And then A Grand Day Out did get shown on TV, and I think back then on Channel 4, and it had a following, but it was very slow grow, really, the whole Wallace and Gromit thing. And it was Creature Comforts that everybody wanted. And so we did commercials, we did all sorts based on Creature Comforts.
Wallace and Gromit's been around for a very long time now. It's been with you for a huge part of your career. And it does seem like it's been, like you say, a slow growth, but then at some point it just became like this very quintessential thing that was just like, this is Britain in a box. One of the things that's really fascinating about your filmmaking is that you're really a comedian. Like, because you're writing these characters in these situations and they're very funny. And that's not something that is natural to everyone. I'm surprised you weren't into stand-up or anything.
And that's the thing. I always feel I'm so lucky to have found a channel for humour because I couldn't do stand-up. There's a statue of Wallace and Gromit in my hometown of Preston. I think, how come this incredibly shy, I was painfully shy as a teenager and growing up, and how come that's all happened? But it's obviously, we all have humour in different ways. And I'm just so glad to have found a channel for it, something I can do well. And found a kind of a unique way of doing it. It's all through discovery and experiment, really, not really knowing what you're doing at the time. It's not logically worked out. My career hasn't been worked out. I've just done one thing as it comes and then see what happens next. And this humour, I don't know where, how it happens. My dad noticed it when I was making films as a kid. I made this film, and it's probably not even viewable, it's not very good because it's hardly in focus. But it was a clay figure walks on, and then for some reason, I can't remember why, but his head drops off. And he was like a little clay figure about 5 inches high. And he spends his time looking for his head, and he can't find it. And then he's really sad. And so he sits down, and he's got no head, but he puts his head in his hands. And I remember my dad saying, it's amazing how much pathos comes over, like both funny. But there's something quite moving about the fact that he's lost his head and can't find it. And my dad observed it back then. But I think that's what you can do with clay, and it's to do with the restrictions of it and the fact that you've got gravity holding it down, and you haven't got the whole universe at your fingertips to fly around, and you've got to make humor out of what you've got.
It's very much based in the reality of the universe because, and that universe is very familiar because it's us in a way. So you do have some restrictions.
Yes, that's right. Jumping from that to Gromit, for example, that's how Gromit came about, unplanned. And I had bigger plans that he was going to have a mouth and he was going to be yapping and making almost human vocal noises like Scooby-Doo, like he would copy Wallace going. But come the first day of filming at film school, I couldn't really get my fingers around the model to get to his mouth. And because of the situation where he was, because Wallace was using him as like a support trestle table for what he was sawing through, and he was looking really hacked off. And I found that I could only move his eyebrow up and down, and I just kept doing that. So all I could do was move his brow, looking like, oh, rolling his eyes, and all this again, long suffering. And suddenly, in that moment, found through these kind of accidental things and practical reasons, his character suddenly jumped out. He was born in that moment, really, and in a way, so was Wallace, because he became an introvert dog that couldn't say what he wanted, but everyone could see what he was saying, much louder than maybe if he had a voice. That he was less dog-like, he was more human, more feeling, more intelligent. And Wallace became less of those things, less sensitive and less, more comic, and well-meaning but ridiculously an idiot sort of thing. Clever with his inventions, but totally deluded.
We were talking about how Wallace and Gromit has been with you for a very long time. And in that, the years, you've also made other films and worked on other projects. But every once in a while, a new Wallace and Gromit thing comes up. And I'm curious about how those characters live with you on a day-to-day basis. Do the stories just one day you're like, this might be fun to explore? Or do you sit with the stories for a long time? How do you know that they're Wallace and Gromit stories? And I ask because these characters are so iconic and the stories always feel like they belong to these characters. You can't imagine anyone else doing these things.
Interesting. I think all those things are true, really. Everything starts with just staring out the window and or doodling and very small, simple sketches that don't mean anything. Yeah. Sometimes when I'm staring out the window or on the phone or something, I'm just drawing Gromit's face over and over. I'm filling a page up with Wallace and Gromit's face, the same thing. But sometimes one will just go a bit different, or I'll just draw something unexpected because of what comes up in the conversation, or something that comes on the TV, or I'll just draw something a bit different. You know, I do spend a long time searching for ideas and just writing things down and drawing, and a lot of it doesn't go anywhere. But then occasionally something will tip. There'll be something that you go, oh boy, that could be something that has legs. There's an area here now that's opening up that I've never seen Wallace and Gromit quite in that area before. And that really seems to lend itself to their world. And I can see it visually that there's something here. They're almost like lightning strikes, really, where you go, yes, oh, that's something. You know it inside that this could develop. You may not have got the whole idea yet or what quite happens. And it may take a long time and a lot of struggling with it to find something in it. But you know at heart there's something.
When did the concept for the new film kind of start to come together for you?
Vengeance Most Foul. Yeah, that was one of those ideas that quite often while you're working on one thing, you get an idea for something else as well. And then because you can't do that idea, it starts to burn on your mind because you can't do anything about it. You start getting like a bit excited about it. And anyway, while filming Curse of the Were-Rabbit, because I guess there are mechanical gnomes in that, quite limited mechanical gnomes, this idea came about of what if Wallace was to invent a robot gnome. It wasn't even a smart gnome back then because we didn't even use that term. It was a robot gnome to help Gromit in the garden with his garden chores. And I just had that idea on the back burner for quite a while. And when I became more freed up after making Early Man, I started tinkering with it a bit more. I pitched a couple of ideas to people in Ireland. It was very much inspired by a movie I remember from the 60s called Village of the Damned, based on John Wyndham's The Midwich Cuckoos. And it's always freaked me out, that film, in a good way. You know, I was intrigued and I loved sci-fi that was a bit scary. And it was the way the kids would stop and turn very deliberately, all at once, a uniform, all controlled by one alien force kind of thing. And I thought, what if gnomes walked around the streets like that and were a bit scary? And so I played around with this idea, but it was always like, what's causing it and who's behind it? It felt a bit like just, it can't be just technology going wrong again. That doesn't seem that personal. So anyway, it was after quite a while of working on it. It was another lightning strike time. I can't remember where I was when I thought of it, but I was thinking, boy, this could be a great place to bring Feathers McGraw back. One or two people had often said, would you ever bring Feathers back? And there'd never been like a good context for it or a reason that didn't seem like we're just trying to find another story. And then the danger was it would end up not as strong as Wrong Trousers. And so I always dismissed it a bit. But this suddenly felt, this is the perfect place. Back then it was, I was only planning really a 30-minute TV short, really. And then with this thought, I thought, Feathers could enter at the end of episode one, and then there could be a second episode. It could be like a real like holiday special, and then started working with Mark Burton on the story. And then Merlin Crossingham came in as well. As I asked him to direct alongside me across the whole thing as it got bigger. And but we had so much trouble making it work as two episodes. It was a real problem. And so we eventually tried one hour and a half, three act structure as one story. And then all our problems got solved. And with Feathers on board, it seemed to lend itself now to a feature length film.
Were you already in production when the change to go from a two episode or three episode special to a feature film happened?
No, in a good way, because of COVID, we got delayed because Chicken Run 2 kept getting, Dawn of the Nugget kept getting delayed. So it gave us a bit of space to decide these things, to try out different formats. We tried for quite a while with the two episode thing, but then, Netflix said they would probably show the two episodes back to back anyway, and they would probably chop out the credits at the end of the first episode, so it continues on. So we thought, if that's the case, I wonder if Netflix and BBC might be open to a whole feature length. And they both went, yeah! So we were in business.
That's amazing. I wanted to ask you about your relationship with Merlin and what he brings to Wallace and Gromit, because I understand he's been involved with Wallace and Gromit for a long time too. And as the creator of these characters and kind of the gatekeeper and carer for these characters for such a long time, I'm curious about finding the right person to work with you and keep the characters true to the original vision, and how you move forward with working with a partner on these projects where before it was not really just you, but really they were coming all from you.
Yeah. On each film, Grand Out was just me. Wrong Trousers, I worked with Steve Box. I was directing. We both animated 90% of it together with some help from a couple of other animators. And Close Shave, the crew got bigger. And even on Wrong Trousers, I animated just about all of Wallace and Gromit. And Steve animated nearly all of Feathers McGraw. We crossed over a little bit. So I was always very protective with Wallace and Gromit themselves, because also the characters then needed a lot of sculpting through, like with lip sync and what have you. But come Close Shave, we developed a system where we unplugged the mouths, the clay mouths, each animator. There was a small crew still of about eight of us. But to keep in style, to keep it on model, we would have mouths pre-made in molds, so that the animator would have a set of about 12 different mouth shaped syllables to plug and unplug, so that Wallace stayed consistent. So I was slowly learning to trust other people with it, but keep people on model as well. That's the difficulty. And as it went on, and that's about when Merlin joined the company, actually. And Merlin was always like one of the hottest animators in the company. And he was very quick at getting things. And so it wasn't long before I was getting distracted on all sorts of things and planning and writing and things like that. So Merlin played a great role. I was able to trust him very much in looking after the characters. And he was always good at putting over to animators what was important and mentoring animators in that way. So that has developed very well over the years. He's been brilliant at that. So it seemed only natural, because directing a full-length film like this is such a journey. It's quite difficult. I'm quite collaborative in some ways. And so I asked Merlin to direct across the whole movie with me, because he knows the characters so well, as well as all his directing skills. And I think we've learned to share the kind of the humour, and we get it. And I always think because I directed alongside Steve Box, first of all with Peter Lord on Chicken Run, Steve Box on Curse of the Were-About, and now Merlin. I think it's important, because there are different structures. You can have someone as a co-director who's actually below the director, or you can have one person directing, but you need a quiet structure underneath you in order just to get things done, because everyone needs directing. And somebody described directing a film as like being pecked by 100 chickens all day long, every day.
For years.
For years. Yeah.
So can you talk a little bit about how working with Merlin and being that collaborative has changed, and maybe not changed, but how it helped progress the story of Vengeance Most Foul and the film production itself a little, maybe a little bit faster, since now there's two of you. Four eyeballs and eight hands is better than two and two, right?
Actually, that helps to complete where I was going, which was that if you to ask someone to direct alongside you, I always find it's important they don't just come along at too late a stage and try to somehow get it all in their heads. It's good to have them involved in the story stage and early on while we're still trying to figure out structure. And I brought along a lot of the ideas myself, which remained in place, and some of the scene ideas, a lot of the scene ideas, but it still needed a lot of work figuring out the structural aspects of it all. And that's where Mark Burton was. He was there all along through that and has very much a story head on his shoulders. So I brought in Merlin quite early so that we both knew what the struggles were and what the problems were for the story, so that we were both coming up with them. And there was a point when we got reasonably happy with this story, with what Mark had written, we then broke into storyboard. We did a lot of that over lockdown, actually, from home and briefing story artists. We started to split the film up, both look after different scenes. But it was important that we both had that kind of understanding of what the whole film was about, what we were aiming for, and that we weren't building the bridge from two different sides to make sure we're making the same film and that we met in the middle. We would just talk all the time about it, really. That was really important, about what the vision was, what the story was about, what the joke was, what was important about it, who the characters are. Even though we both know it, we talk about Gromit a lot and how he thinks, how he reacts, what Wallace represents, what Gromit represents thematically. That was a big thing. And it would really be Mark Burton, the screenwriter, Merlin, and myself would talk all the time, three of us. And then we'd get the story artists involved, we'd get the scenes, we start creating a reel, animatic story reel. We'd do the voices ourselves, just scratch voices, temporary music, start editing the whole thing together with our editor, and we'd just review that a million times, see how the stories work. There's usually lots of places where the story was starting to sag, these scenes are in the wrong order, whatever it was. Talk about with Mark and the editor. We get opinions in from the studio. We have a kind of creative council who would look at what we're doing and feedback on it and suggest things. Flicks would have Zoom calls with us and have views on it as well. And often when people give opinions, it's an important thing for people to know. A student was asking me this the other day. Listen for where everyone's having the problem, not so much to their solutions. I thought that was always good advice. So when the storyboard started to finally, everything seemed to come together and make sense, and things were funnier and scenes were tighter and gags were landing, we'd start to get into shooting, and then shooting on the studio. Obviously, all this time as well, we'd be working with the art department, the set design, the character build, all these things would be going on simultaneously. And then we would decide who wants to direct which scenes. Because in the storyboarding, we'd often cross over or we'd take over a scene because it's someone had too much on their hands and so the other one would take over. So we both knew the whole film like the back of our hands, really. So we could, in theory, both direct any scene. So that's what happened. We split the scene between us. And to decide who did what scene, we would first of all just say, what scene have you always longed to direct in the movie? It's a difficult one because you'd obviously like to direct everything, yeah, because you've been so with it all the way from concept and everything. But it worked out very well. We both knew what scenes each other wanted to direct, so we carried on with that, and then we split the rest so it doesn't look like Merlin's doing one half and I'm doing the other half. So we'd checkerboard throughout the movie. As the dailies came in every morning, we would talk about every shot and what we're missing, what could be better. And Will Beecher, the supervising animator, would be involved in all of that as well, what he could feed back to the animators. On Early Man, I was much more in edit and storyboard and directing to animation directors, which was Merlin and Will Beecher. And I missed being on the studio floor talking and directing animators personally. I really missed that. So that's what me and Merlin were doing on this. That's why we're both equally directing, is so that we both can be on the floor also directing animators and talking to them. Great to get back into that again.
You were both working on the film until the very last minute. I think 2 weeks before premiere, you were still working on it. That's always the pressure. You have to finish them at some point, but that extra pressure of you have a deadline, this thing is going to get shown, it needs to get finished. Can you talk a little bit about how you work to those tight deadlines and what extra can you possibly do to move things along faster when it is such an intricate and difficult and time-consuming way to make movies.
One thing that really helps is to have a really great producer, which is Richard Beak, who really helped, and Stephanie as well. But he was so good at understanding us as directors. I've worked with him many times before on different feature films, and he's very good at accommodating the creative side. It's not just about meeting deadlines and budget and then cracking the whip. He's quite a creative producer in that sense, in that if something is struggling, he'll really help you get the movie you want and make sure by doing lots of really good pre-planning early on. And he made sure that we were having all our meetings with the visual effects department, the art department, the model makers, the way ahead in advance. And at the time, it seemed, why are we doing this now? But it's so distracting. But that's what helped us be on schedule the whole time and get the film we wanted to make. So it was a lot easier, so that when it came, for example, to the music record, it was all in place because he'd scheduled in meetings with the composers and very early on, and to get them sketching up music for different scenes. On just a practical side, on the animation, there does come a bit of a crunch, because obviously we have a superb team of animators. I think they're the best in the world, really. Animators work slow. That's what animation's about. And so there is pressure, but we don't want the animation to suffer because of the pressure. So it does come a point where maybe a shot has come in where the shot isn't quite what you wanted, or because that's the thing about stop motion, it's a linear performance. You can't just go back in and noodle with the movement. And there's all sorts of things you can do. You can do a cut back or shoot the last bit of the shot again or whatever. But it is quite a pressure on us. Do we live with the shot that we don't quite like? Or sometimes with a bit of editing, you can get to like the shot more. Or you can do some editing of frames and speed up things digitally now. That is something you can do because of digital effects. Beaky would keep back a sort of a list of the shots you would ideally like to shoot again if you could. And so he would save those for the very end of the shoot.
Always have a good producer. The lesson learned here. You mentioned earlier that you doodle and you sketch when you're looking out the window or on the phone. Is that something that you've done for your entire life where you just like randomly draw? Do you carry a sketchbook with you everywhere, or is it just when it happens to strike, you just grab whatever is nearest?
I did used to do it all the time, and I should do as well, really. I'm a bit of a fair weather sketchy. Sometimes I have one, and I want to do that more now that I've finished filming. Just keep sketching, really, of things that I see. And I love wildlife and looking out the window at the birds and stuff like that. So a lot of my sketching is that. It's not all animation and cartoons. And I love painting wildlife as well, and not just wildlife, but nature scenes, any old scene, take a picture of and then do a painting of. So I have to keep creative all the time.
And is that how you stay creative, by sketching?
It is, yeah, I love that. And what I love is actually when I'm doing a painting, I'm in full control of it. I don't have to show it to anyone and get feedback. I don't have notes coming in about this could be, this scene could look a bit, I don't know. It's different with painting, but yeah.
Are we going to get to see the Nick Park art show at some point?
I don't know. I'm not sure. I do love doing it. I think it's the one thing I will always keep doing.
You've won a number of awards and been celebrated with many accolades over the course of your career. Is there one that has like a special place in your heart or that you not value more than others, but that is just more special to you for some reason?
Oh, that's a good one. Probably is. Yeah, obviously, the Oscars and the BAFTA, you can't really second those. But there are, yeah. You know, my mind has gone blank as well. It's not really an award, but to have a statue of Wallace and Gromit in my hometown, that was a memorable thing. And what else? I couldn't imagine anything. As I said, it's just this kind of quite shy boy in Preston that. Million miles away from the movie industry, to come back to my hometown and see the statue there is incredible. And the way that Wallace and Gromit have had their own stamps made, postage stamps, their own 50p coin made, they're accolades in themselves.
I want to finish by asking you about your parents. They pushed you to follow your creative dreams and to pursue this thing that really might never make you money. You might be struggling for your whole career. Did they get to see that statue in your hometown and say, "That's my boy"?
No, I wish they had. They would be so proud, really proud. Yeah, they were always so supportive and thrilled, really, by everything that was happening. They saw the Oscars. My mum passed away about, I think it was 3 years ago now, and my dad about 20 years ago. But my dad was very much like Wallace. He had a similar personality, and he loved being compared to Wallace as well. Whereas my mum was a lot more like Gromit and would roll her eyes, and she hated any media. She wouldn't want to be on TV or anything or radio. Whereas my dad loved it. And my dad spent his time in the shed making things, and he'd have ideas just like Wallace and go ahead, and you'd hear some banging and sawing and drilling, and then a few minutes later, he'd come out with something for the living room, some kind of shelf thing for the living room.
Their spirits live on eternally in Wallace and Gromit. An amazing tribute.
And that was our conversation with director Nick Park. You can now watch the latest entry into the Wallace and Gromit franchise, Wallace and Gromit: Vengeance Most Foul, streaming on Netflix worldwide. The SparkCast is a production of the Spark Computer Graphics Society. Opening and closing credits by Michael Edlund. Editing and additional production support by Marina Antunes. You can find out more about Spark, listen to previous episodes of the podcast, and find out more about upcoming events at sparkcg.org.